Lecture 5, From Mount Athos to Marathon.
Welcome back. News of the great Persian victory of that Phoenician fleet over the rebel Ionians at the Battle of Lade spread like wildfire through the Aegean and the Mediterranean. Some of the news was carried by survivors of the battle, and one of those survivors was that Phocaean leader, Dionysius, who had tried in vain to persuade his Ionian confederates to train seriously for this battle and thus have a hope of winning it. When the battle was lost, Dionysius led his three ships back to shore, loaded their gear and their masts and sails on board, and headed not for safety, but into the heart of Persian-controlled waters, knowing that every warship the great king had been deployed at Lade, and that the ports of the Persians were now stripped of defenses. He sailed all the way to Phoenicia, attacked Persian merchant shipping, loaded his ships with loot, and then sailed to the other end of the Mediterranean, all the way to Sicily, where he set himself up as a pirate. And from then on for the rest of his life, preyed on the shipping of Etruscans, of Phoenicians, of Carthaginians, but never on his fellow Greeks. Such was the end of Dionysius of Phocaea. Meanwhile, Darius had resolved to remember the Athenians. They had in fact done him a favor. Empires must grow, but even the most brutal autocracy needs excuses and pretexts for its wars. The Athenians had handed him a wonderful pretext. Here they were outside his empire, he had never injured them, and they had sent men across to participate in about the year 499, 498, in the burning of his provincial capital at Sardis. Now it was time to punish them. The Ionians had been defeated at Lade. The great Ionian revolt was over, probably in about 494 BC. He set about planning the punishment of Athens, but also adding all of mainland Greece to his realm. He had, in fact, had a doctor, a Greek doctor named Democedes, who was from a western Greek city, who had helped Darius get through the recovery from an injury. And he had had that doctor taken on a Phoenician ship with Persian guards through the Greek world already to show the Persians the harbors and cities, scout out the coasts and the sea routes, preparatory for a takeover of all of the Greek world, a takeover that would have carried him right into what is today southern France. And the Persians, we know, considered that the Greeks were all that really stood between them and a dominion that would reach the Atlantic Ocean, because the Greek armies were the last really strong resistance, Greek armies and Greek fleets, that the Persians felt they would have to face in their bid to take over Europe. So it was a grand campaign, but a small announced target, Athens and its neighboring city, Eretria, who were now going to be punished for participating in the Ionian revolt. The Persians still didn't like the idea of trusting their troops to ships, so they decided that the army would march around the north end of the Aegean Sea to what was called Thrace, while the fleet, that Phoenician fleet, now augmented by the Ionians who had been brought back to the fold and had their own naval contingents to serve the great king, another fleet, this time about 300 ships, would parallel the army just along the coast. These triremes, as I said, went ashore every night so that the crews could spill onto shore, sleep, have their evening meal, and then get back on board ship. These aren't like British men of war that are at sea for months or even more than a year without letting the men onto land. So this was the idea, a fleet and an army in parallel around the north end of the Aegean. And halfway along in Thrace, they would come to the famous gold mines on the island of Thasos, and on the mainland in Thrace by the river Strymon, the mountain called Pangaea, all the earth that seemed to have great ores of gold and silver in it and was the source of a lot of the wealth of the northern Aegean. If that could be captured by the Persians, it would pay for the whole campaign. A kinsman of Darius, who we shall meet several times in the future, named Mardonius, a Persian prince who is of the royal family, he had the dream of becoming the satrap of Greece once Greece was conquered and brought into the Persian world. He was very happy when his kinsman, King Darius, sent heralds from the Persians into Thrace into Macedonia, which is north of the main part of Greece, and into Greece itself, going to every city-state and asking for those tokens of submission to the great king, earth and water. And this was the point at which it became plain to all the Greeks that they were targets too. Darius launched his invasion. The army marched without incident along the northern shore of the Aegean, and the fleet kept pace with it. And all along the way, tribes and cities surrendered to them. In fact, all the way up to Macedon, Macedonia is the region, Macedon is the kingdom, everyone capitulated. The great king's western frontier now extended into the Balkans. It had already been a success when a terrible natural disaster put an end to this invasion, which took place probably in 493 or 492 BC, a year after the great victory over the Ionian fleet at Lade. This time it was a force of nature, as I said, that brought the great king's ambition low. His fleet had to navigate a great cape that sticks out into the northern Aegean. On the southern tip of that cape is a mountain more than a mile high, Mount Athos, today the holy mountain of the Greek Orthodox religion, studded with monasteries. But in that time, a formidable hazard to navigation because Mount Athos brews at its tall summit storms. It catches clouds, katabatic winds sweep down its slopes and hit the sea and spread out in ship-killing waves. And it was one of these great winds, a north wind, that came down on the fleet of Darius, 300 ships strong, as it was trying to get past the cape of Mount Athos. That great wind destroyed them all. Herodotus, who gives us the story, says that the men spilled into the sea, that as they swam over to the land, they were confronted by sheer cliffs and couldn't get up onto the shore, that they were eaten by monsters. We believe these are probably sharks that are eating these hapless mariners from half a world away, it would seem, the sunny coasts of Phoenicia. Thousands upon thousands of men perished. The entire fleet was lost. A terrible setback. The army returned home, having left garrisons here and there and administrators to take control of the newly submitted lands that were now part of the great king's realm. Darius then set his mind to other approaches and decided on a straight across attack through the islands of the Cyclades. But before we follow him there, I would like to tell you that I have been lucky enough to be part of a scientific expedition to go to Mount Athos and look under the sea for remains of those famous ships of King Darius that were lost in that great storm. My colleagues and I, Greek, Canadian, American, we were all together on the Greek research vessel Aegeo. We went up there and spent weeks off Mount Athos using side-scan sonar to identify hundreds of bumps on the seafloor, each of which could have been a shipwreck, and then sending down robots on tethers and going down ourselves in a little two-person submersible called the Thetis, named after the mother, the sea goddess who was the mother of the famous hero Achilles. One of the robots, by the way, as sort of a joke, was named Achilles himself, a smaller version of the big mothership. In that little submersible was room for a Navy pilot and an archaeologist, and we would pick the side-scan sonar targets that looked best and go down on the seafloor and see if one of them wasn't a shipwreck. We were very sorry to find that erosion of Mount Athos, which is now a bare cone of rock, has spilled over the years since Greece was deforested, the topsoil into the sea. The skirts of that peninsula under the water are now cloaked with sediments that used to be on the land, and it's very hard to find a spot where you can see anything ancient. But down there amongst the coral reefs and the sponges, we did find modern wrecks. We knew that it was a place where ships for many centuries after King Darius' disaster did continue to go to the bottom, and we were lucky enough to encounter a fisherman, a local fisherman, who had dragged up in his nets from 300 feet down, just off the point of the cape, a helmet, a Corinthian helmet of early Greek style that he showed to us, the picture of. He'd already turned it over to the Antiquities Authority, and he offered to take us back to the spot where he hauled up that bronze helmet. It was the last day of the expedition. It's always an axiom in the archaeological world that the big finds are made on the last day, usually after lunch. And we took our fisherman on board. I think he felt he'd been brought onto the Starship Enterprise when he found himself on the bridge of this research vessel with all of its space-age equipment. But he took us to the place. He pointed exactly to the spot in the water and said it was there. And we put down one of the robots on the spot. And as we checked our charts, we found he had pointed us to our side scan sonar target number one out of the 250 that we had encountered. So we were being brought back to our beginning. We had not yet checked it. As the robot got to the bottom and turned on its lights and fired up its camera, there transmitted to us up the cable from the video camera on the floor, within a few yards of where it had hit the bottom, was a great pot on its side, and glinting in the mouth of the pot was something green. We could even tell that underwater. And green is the color to which bronze oxidizes. And so we were very excited, immediately thinking that we had found another relic of this lost fleet. The little Achilles maneuvered itself over to the pot. Young Angelos, who was the man at the controls up on the bridge of the ship, he was the youngest member of the team. He had misspent his teen years in video arcades. He alone had the gift of maneuvering all those joysticks so that the titanium grab arm, the camera lens, the lights, the engines of the and thrusters of the little Achilles to take it up and down or forward and back could all be maneuvered at once. He had the arm reach in, grab that green thing, and bring it up to the surface. And it turned out to be, we believe, a relic of that lost fleet of King Darius. It was a weapon about a foot long, made of bronze. It was from a spear, but not from the working end of the spear, the weapon end. That would have been an iron or steel blade. This bronze thing was the butt spike, so that you could thrust your spear into the ground at night by your bivouac, and if there were an alarm, you could leap up, grab the spear ready for action, and charge off into the battle. Also, if your spear broke, you could use that end, that butt end, as a subsidiary weapon. It's not yet been dated, but we believe it will be soon, because inside that hollow bronze weapon called a sauroter, a lizard killer, was the wood of the original spear shaft, at least 2,000 years old, and we hope that through radiocarbon dating it will be possible to determine whether or not this remarkable weapon found alongside that helmet that the fishermen had already discovered does date, in fact, as a relic of this great disaster that carried the Persian hopes to the bottom of the sea of an easy attack on Athens. In the year 490, a couple of years after the Mount Athos disaster, King Darius tried again. He sent a Mede this time. We don't often read about those people, the Medes and the Persians, that the Medes get a leading role. But there was a Mede who was considered a very good military leader named Datis, and Darius sent along with him a Persian named Artaphernes, and the two of them loaded an army and horses into these ships that they had converted to troop carriers and horse carriers, and transported the Persian army, this time straight across the Aegean, island-hopping their way, places like Naxos and Delos, all the islands submitting to the Persians as they came, these islanders who'd never dreamed they would see Persian troops on their shores, immediately submitting to the great king. And in this way, the fleet made its way unopposed across the Aegean in the fair summer weather, went first to Eretria, up there on the island of Euboea, after a short siege, conquered that town, deported the Eretrians to Persia, just as the Assyrians and Babylonians had deported Jews from Israel and other peoples from their homelands, and resettled them at a place as a sort of semi-enslaved working community that were still there half a century later when Herodotus came through and met the descendants of those Eretrians, those deported people. So these masses of people on the move as a result of warfare and so on, they're not just a function of our modern chaotic world. They go back to the ancient world as well as a tool of terror, as a tool of kings and conquerors having one more threat to hold over the heads of people who are resisting them. From Eretria, that force that Darius had put together got back in their ships and went the short distance south to the coast of Attica, the territory of Athens. The place they chose to land was Marathon. They were led there by an Athenian turncoat who was traveling with them. This is one way that great powers conquer. They don't just line up on the frontiers of the country that they want to beat and launch an attack. they find someone inside the gates who will collaborate with them, who will bring over to them certain disaffected minorities in the population and make it easy for them to get inside and to win and get them people fighting for them and undermining the resistance within their enemy's own citadel. That's what happened at Athens. A couple of decades before the Persians landed at Marathon, 22 years in fact, in about 512 BC, the Athenians had thrown out the last of their tyrants, those dictatorial nobles who had seized power, kept it all in the dynasty of one family called the Pisistratids. The last of these tyrants was a man named Hippias. As you can tell from his name, Hippias, the family liked horses and horse racing. Hippias had then gone away from Greece in exile and had been absorbed into the Persian realm and was now traveling with the Persians as a puppet who would be placed back in charge of Athens should they win and who the Persians were counting on both for strategic advice and for friends of his inside the city to undermine unity and to open the gates. The Athenians were aware of this. They knew that Hippias, their old tyrant, was with the Persians. And when they came to Marathon, there was a great debate in Athens. Should they go out and meet the Persians on the field? Nobody had beaten the Persians in a pitched battle at this point. The best that anybody had done was King Croesus of Lydia fighting Cyrus to a standstill. And here was tiny Athens, the total military force, only about 10,000, up against a great king who could muster more than a million people to throw at them. Should they not rather stay within their city, sit tight, guard their gates, and hope that they could withstand a siege and eventually the Persians would go home frustrated? There was at this time in Athens, almost by chance, an Athenian of great military genius and inspiring presence named Miltiades, or as a Greek would have called him, Miltiades. Miltiades was of an Athenian family, but he knew the Persians because he had fought not against them, but with them. Among those waves of adventurers who'd been spreading out from the motherland of Greece over the past decades, mercenaries and explorers and soldiers of fortune, this Miltiades belonged to a family that had been in the forefront. They had established a little private fiefdom for their noble house on the north shore of the Hellespont, that long peninsula that borders the Hellespont and looks across to Troy. That had been their family's domain, and from there they'd enriched themselves by preying upon or levying tolls on the shipping that came out of the Black Sea into the Aegean. In this role as tyrant of the Thracian Chersonesus, this little neck of land, Miltiades had become a vassal of the great king. He'd been absorbed into the empire along with the Greeks of Asia, and when King Darius, some years before, had led an army into Europe, crossed the Danube River over a quickly built bridge, and led an army up into the land of the Scythians, what would be in the area around Romania and the Ukraine and Russia, on a vast campaign of conquest, Miltiades was appointed to guard the bridge. This is how much the great king trusted him. He did guard that bridge, but later on he participated in the Ionian Revolt, and he had to flee for his life after the Battle of Lade when the great king was after all those who had resisted him, all those rebel leaders who had dared to rise in rebellion. This had brought Miltiades back to Athens, the one man who really knew the king, who had talked with Darius, who had been a friend of his, and had carried tremendous weight with the Athenians when Miltiades said to them, "We should take the offensive, we should march to Marathon and meet them there." Marathon lies, as you are probably already guessing, about 26 miles away from Athens. The distance is, in fact, the basis of the modern race, the Marathon. It's actually only about 25 and some miles. The Marathon got changed when the Olympics were held in London, and the reviewing platform, it was back in the 1920s, for the royal family turned out to be about half a mile further on than the proper end of the race, which was 25 point something miles, so they've all been 26 point something since. At any rate, Miltiades led the full levy of Athenian hoplites. These are men of the upper middle class. They're landowners. They are the sort of yeoman stock, not quite a majority of the Athenian population of 30 or 40,000, but at 10,000, a very substantial portion of it. Most of the Athenians were, in fact, unlanded, poor workers and laborers, craftsmen. These hoplites put on their helmets, their breastplates, or actually handed them to their slaves. Each man had a slave to carry the 60 pounds of armor. And they marched off across the hills, it's rugged terrain, from Athens to Marathon, where the Persians had landed. The Persians had set up camp there. The field did not look as it looks today. A colleague of mine, a great geologist named Rick Dunn, who I once worked with in Portugal on a project, we were trying to locate Phoenician harbors around the coast of Portugal through remote sensing and through geological coring. Rick Dunn, in 1996-97, when he was attached to the American School of Classical Studies in Athens and working at the Wiener Laboratory, went out, did coring all over the plain of Marathon, and showed that this vast expanse of dry land that is there today was in fact featuring a large lake, a freshwater lake, a stream that ran from the lake into the sea, and marshes all around the lake. So there was in fact a very constricted area for a battlefield. You don't realize that when you go today. And the Greeks set themselves up on a slope above one edge of this rather difficult piece of terrain and guarded the pass to Athens. No matter how big an army you are, you don't dare leave an enemy behind you, or they will get you in the rear or in the flank. So the Persians were now pinned at Marathon by Miltiades and his Athenians. And though they had all their ships there and their horses and their so on, they couldn't attack the Athenian positions with the cavalry because the horses couldn't charge up the rocky slope at the entrenched Athenian position. The Athenians sent to the other Greeks for help. They had allies. They sent a runner named Pheidippides all the way to Sparta. In those days, there were day runners in Athens. That means a runner who can run all day long, a hemerodromos. He can run all day long, and it's only in the 20th century, late 20th century, that people have been able to duplicate the exploits of these great runners of antiquity. He ran all the way to Sparta, not stopping day and night, got to Sparta, told them that the Persians had arrived, asked for help, and was told by the Spartans, "We are in the middle of a religious festival. It's the festival of the Carneia, and until the full moon is past, we cannot assist you." So Pheidippides had to run all the way back to Athens with this terrible news. The only people who came were the townsmen of a little village just outside Athenian territory, a place called Plataea, that we will meet again because it's going to be the site of another confrontation between Greeks and Persians. But these Plataeans put together their little army of 1,000 and joined the Athenians. So now we've got 10,000 troops facing, allegedly, according to Herodotus, hundreds of thousands out there on the plain of Marathon. What are they going to do? Well, the Persians were being frustrated in their expectation that they would get a message that Athens had opened its gates. What could have been more favorable? All the Athenian soldiers are out now of the city. Wouldn't the traitors open the gates? Well, this is part of Miltiades' genius. The would-be traitors are probably part of the army. So they are with him under his eye, and the loyal people are back home guarding the city, which is now emptied of its army. The days went by. Miltiades, who was just one among many generals, and in fact there was a Polemarchos, a war leader of the Athenians, who should have been in charge, but because Miltiades knew the great king, because of his charisma, he was given the leading role. He finally decided, you know, we need to attack them. What seems to have precipitated the attack is a detail that doesn't exist for us in the old count of Herodotus, the earliest one we have. The Persians, of course, never wrote about this at all. Persian history does not record its defeats. It's meant to glorify the great king. Herodotus simply tells us that on a given day, Miltiades ordered a charge. But from 1,500 years later, from a little dictionary of the ancient world that existed in Byzantium, it's called the Suda, S-U-D-A, there's an entry for a popular saying called horos hippeis, the horse are away. And there's an explanation that the Ionians, who were perforce fighting with King Darius' troops against the Athenians and were there on the plain of Marathon, flashed a signal to the Athenians with Miltiades up on the slope above the plain saying, horos hippeis, the horse are away, in some sort of Morse code. What this meant was that the fearsome Persian cavalry had been loaded the night before into the transports. Those ships had slipped away in the darkness. They were going to try to get around the point of Attica and attack Athens from its own shore, leaving the army, helpless and unknowing, pinned down at Marathon. True or not, it explains what happened. Miltiades said, arm yourselves, we will attack. He lined up his phalanx, his shield-to-shield array of men, several men deep, strong on the wings, weak on the center, so he could spread it wide. He headed them down and along the plain to a narrow place near the lake and the marshes, where the Persians, on seeing him come, started to muster to meet him, and he led them at a run. They ran a mile, wearing 50 to 60 pounds of armor, each man, to confront the Persians. For a long time, it was doubted by modern historians that this was even possible. Who could run a mile? Certainly not me, said all of these soft professors like myself. And then in 1976 at Pennsylvania State University, the classicists asked the physical education majors if they would please put on 60 pounds of equipment and run a mile and ask them at the end, do you think you could fight? They said, of course we could. And to make the point even more clearly, Peter Krentz, a great classics professor at Davison, has recently interviewed lots and lots of people in the American military and found it, crying out loud, it's part of basic training to be able to carry that kind of a pack at a dead run for a considerable distance and still be combat ready when you arrive. So there's no reason to doubt that there was that charge, that extraordinary run at an opponent which had never known defeat and seemed unbeatable. And when they collided, what Miltiades expected happened. He'd weakened the center, so he had a long line. The center gave way, but the wings of his Athenian army with the Plataean allies pushed in and brought the Persians in retreat into chaos behind their own center. The center had won but was now isolated. The Greeks turned on them and pushing ran the remnant of the Persian army into the marsh. And there they were butchered as they floundered around among the yellow water lilies on that plain of Marathon. Lots of herbs and wildflowers at Marathon. The name of the place means fennel. And they finally got them out of the marsh, onto the beach, and as they're trying to get up onto their ships, the Athenians pursue them even there, fully armed, onto the ships, grabbing onto the railings themselves, hoisting themselves up. The battle continued on the decks as the Persians tried to escape. The brother of a famous Athenian, a poet named Aeschylus, who we will meet again, he's going to write a play about the Persian Wars. This brother was grabbing a railing to hoist himself up, and a Persian took an axe and cut off that Athenian's hand, and he bled to death. 192 Athenians died on the field at Marathon. They took a tally. It's just hard to know whether to believe it or not. 6,400 of the enemy died as well. It's certainly true that in very well-attested battles, ancient and modern, you do get that kind of incredible disparity once a rout has begun, once the enemy, even if they are larger, have thrown down their weapons and begin to run, the butchery can be terrifying. The Athenians then, under Miltiades, sent a runner back to Athens, and that's the origin of the original Marathon run, that young man who raced through the hills to carry the word to Athens, not only to shout, Nike, Nike, victory, but to warn them that the fleet was coming around and they must be prepared for the horsemen to appear off their coast. Miltiades, not content with this, left one of the tribal armies. There are 10 tribes in Athens. They divide the population in these 10 groups. One of the 10 was left under the command of a young man named Aristides the Just to guard the loot and the prisoners, and the others did a quick march across the hills back to Athens, arrived in Athens in time to be arrayed along the beach when the Persian ships came up over the horizon, intending to land, but finding, as if by a nightmare, there was the Athenian army they left behind at Marathon, now waiting for them on the plain. That was the victory at Marathon. It was one of the greatest battles. It was certainly the greatest battle in Athenian history for Athenian morale. They had faced the Persians virtually alone and won. They never forgot their Plataean allies who'd helped them. They also never forgot the Spartan failure to come when called. The Spartans came a few days later and toured the battlefield and offered their congratulations, but they had taken no part in helping the Athenians repulse this initial invasion. From the Persian point of view, maybe even though they lost the 6,400 men, it's just a test after all. You're throwing a little advance force out there, you're seeing how the enemy respond, you're learning about the enemy, and you're learning for next time. The relentlessness of the Persians will now shift into focus. Miltiades offered his helmet in the sanctuary of Zeus at Olympia. It's been discovered there by the German archaeologists who worked there in the 19th century. You can see it in the archaeological museum at Olympia, the very helmet that he wore on the battlefield at Marathon 2,500 years ago. And next to it, in another case, is a helmet from a Persian or Median warrior, shining bronze helmet, sort of a skull cap with a little peak. And that one says, from the Athenians to Zeus, Miltiades' helmet has on the cheek piece inscribed the words, Miltiades dedicates this to Zeus. It was his thank offering for the supreme moment of his own life that chanced to lead a small city-state against the invading force of one of the greatest nations ever seen in the ancient world. That was the victory at Marathon. That was the first Greek success as they confronted the Persians in this epic struggle that we call the Greek and Persian Wars.